Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Over the past year, during the long pandemic, your relationship with your clothes closet has probably changed a little bit.
I am wearing a hoodie and sweatpants and flip-flops. I mean, come on.
I've only worn clothes that can go in the washer-dryer.
I believe that I described my clothing choices to my employer as sack wear.
In addition to the already current face mask, I am adding a more design-friendly second face mask. And one of those, in particular, is this Jurassic Park Samuel L. Jackson one that has him saying, "Hold on to your butts."
I like to dress up.
Ever since the pandemic happened, I have personally found myself dressing in a more formal way.
I put on jeans in the morning. It just makes me feel like still a citizen of the world.
But now those of us who are working at home, and that's more than half of working Americans, at least part-time, we're starting to think about what going back to the office will be like. What exactly is it going to be? And we're thinking about all this with a measure of trepidation.
I'm reluctantly going to retire my outdoor slippers, which differ from my indoor slippers.
Dresses? I don't know if I'm down with them anymore. I really don't.
I don't think I'm going to miss anything about my pre-pandemic wardrobe.
I think I'm one of the strange ones who enjoyed wearing a face mask everywhere. You know, I enjoyed looking like an old-time bandit at the grocery store and even at the bank.
I have these beautiful dresses. They're really sweet. I'm in my closet right now, and there's this polka dot dress that I love, and this other dress that has, like, vine patterns. I want to wear those again.
I am so tired of trying to put on a pair of skinny jeans that I cannot bend my knees in.
Hard pants just are really out.
And also, can we talk about the fact that high heels are really uncomfortable? So, no more heels.
Yeah, so why did we ever bother with high heels? Or ties, or belts, or hard shoes with laces when Velcro does the trick just fine. After this year, how much effort are we going to be willing to expend on the symbolic value of dressing for the office? One person who's thought a lot about that question is Richard Thompson Ford. Ford is a professor of law at Stanford, and his new book is called Dress Codes. It's about how clothing has maintained social hierarchies throughout history and occasionally upended them. Ford himself, it's worth noting, is no slouch in this department. He once made the semifinals in a best-dressed real man contest hosted by Esquire magazine. The New Yorker's Henry Finder called up Richard Thompson Ford to talk about fashion.
So, Rich, what are you wearing right now?
So I'm wearing one of my favorite jackets. It's almost like a Donegal tweed, but it's blue with a light blue. So it kind of comes off also as almost slightly denimish and a blue shirt.
Now, your background is in civil rights and anti-discrimination law. Why did you want to write a book about clothes?
So there are two reasons. One's personal and one's professional. And the personal reason is I like clothes. I'm a little bit of a clothes horse. And more than that, my father was trained as a tailor, actually. And this was at a time when African-Americans in black colleges were often trained in a trade as well as a profession in case racial barriers prevented them from pursuing their profession. And I picked up from him the importance of clothing for him as a black professional navigating some tricky racial dynamics where there weren't very many African Americans. And so clothing and attire became an important way for him to, you know, navigate these racial boundaries. And so that's the personal set of reasons. A professional set is that it was surprising to a lot of people the number of legal disputes that involve dress codes. Either in employment discrimination, workplace dress codes that require women to wear makeup or forbid hairstyles that are typically worn by African Americans or that ban religious garb and therefore are challenged as discriminatory. But I always thought the courts didn't really capture what was most important or at stake in these cases, because they tended to treat dress as trivial. And I always thought that was wrong and missed a lot of the point. So I wanted to dig into it more to get a sense of what was really at stake in all of these disputes about dress codes.
When I'm thinking about dress codes and apparel today, I mean, there's a great quote in your book. It's from the journal Taylor and Cutter from 1931. And it goes, "A loosening of bonds will gradually impel mankind to sag and droop bodily and spiritually. If laces are unfastened, ties loosened, buttons banished, the whole structure of modern dress will come undone. Society will fall to pieces." Now, that seems very relevant right now.
Yes. And so that quote comes from a time when there was a debate around dress reform. And it's, in the book, I talk a lot about these moments of dress reform movements where some group of people will say, you know, these conventions are ridiculous. And this was a point where men were rebelling against starched collars and neckties and all of the other things that men at that time needed to wear. And certainly we were seeing, a real acceleration of that mentality today, where a lot of people would say, you know, dress doesn't matter, fashion doesn't matter, people should just wear whatever is comfortable. I am skeptical that people will ever stop caring entirely about what other people are wearing. And, you know, we are struggling with what comes next. On the one hand, it seems a little silly and, let's say, inauthentic to dress up too much to be on Zoom. Everyone knows you're in your living room. And yet, the desire to express oneself through fashion remains. You get, you know, very subtly expressive forms of athleisure. Mm.
You know, this year has also been one of significant political upheaval, from, you know, last summer's protests against police brutality, deeply divisive election, the riot at the Capitol in January. How do you see clothes functioning politically at these events?
Yeah, it's interesting that in the earliest Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, it seemed that everyone was wearing, just whatever. You didn't see much of a coordination. And, you know, in a sense, that sent a message as well of an outpouring of humanity, an outpouring of outrage and concern over the question of spontaneity. Yes. But, you know, as the protests continued, you started to see dress codes. You saw, for instance, in Brooklyn, transgender people protesting police violence, all wearing suffragette white. You had African-American men in Harlem dressed in suits and ties in order to show their respect for the victims of police violence. And then you had a protest in South Carolina where the organizers actually said, "We ask people to come in their Sunday best." And they were quite explicit that they wanted to make reference to the civil rights movement of the early 1960s, where people wore their Sunday best to desegregate lunch counters, or in the March on Washington, for instance. So they made a very deliberate statement with attire.
One of the most fascinating things about the book for me, and the most illuminating, is the discussion of what we always now disparage as respectability politics, which turns out to be more complicated than we might have thought.
Yes, well, the civil rights movement in the 60s is a great example where, from today's perspective, I think a lot of people describe this as respectability politics in the very negative sense that it's about trying to impress the powerful or to, you know, ingratiate oneself with the powerful by wearing this clothing. You know, one person actually, in responding to the South Carolina protest, said, "It's going to take more than a necktie to get the noose from around our necks." But that's not what was going on in the early civil rights movement. In fact, if you put it in historical context, Black people wearing refined clothing had been a challenge to white supremacy for generations. For instance, in South Carolina, there was a law called the Negro Act, which prohibited slaves from wearing clothing that was considered to be above their condition. And this expectation that African Americans would dress in shabby clothing continued well past emancipation. Black people wearing their Sunday best, particularly on any day other than Sunday, were attacked by racist mobs. Black people in refined clothing were mocked in newspaper cartoons. And so it was understood at the time that a black person in this refined clothing was making a demand, in some sense, for dignified treatment. They were saying, I deserve the status that this attire signifies in our society. And so in that context, the Sunday best civil rights activism wasn't just a way to kind of suck up to white people, but quite the opposite. It was a demand for dignity.
That's so fascinating. So it's a transgressive act.
Yes.
And a strategic one. What would you like to see come back in dress codes after the pandemic, after this slovenly year for many? And what would you be fine with losing?
I would like to see a little more refinement and decorum come back, particularly in environments that are either professional or celebratory. You know, I mean, honestly, I think there's nothing that's more depressing than going out for a big celebration, you know, at a fine restaurant, and somebody shows up in, you know, sweats. So I think people have something of a social responsibility to make an effort in certain environments. And what would I like to see left behind? The dress codes that are heavily regulatory of women, I think the one thing I talk about in the book, and it's really quite breathtaking, is just how relentless and just how punishing dress expectations have been for women, and how contradictory. So women are expected to be decorative, but also to be modest. And they're constantly judged and evaluated on their attire. It's very debilitating. It's sexist. It's wrong. Those kind of dress codes I'd love to see go. Dress codes that prohibit hairstyles often worn by African Americans, and again, particularly women, you know, I've come to believe are quite destructive of self-esteem and unjust barriers to advancement. I'd love to see those go. So now there's something called the Crown Act, which is designed to prohibit that kind of dress code. I think that's a great thing, and I hope it passes.
After a year of kind of minimalism and the emphasis on comfort and small details, like, what's the chance that we just go extreme with our fashions in the post-pandemic years?
I think we might see some of that. I mean, for instance, in the part of history that I describe as the birth of fashion in the book, a lot of this is coming off of waves of the plague. And as the plague wanes, you have this explosion of very expressive fashions that are being used both by elites in order to shore up their elite status, but also by, you know, emergent prosperous classes. You know, another example, after the end of the Spanish flu, you get the Roaring Twenties and flapper styles, which were a dramatic departure from earlier women's clothing. But I think that, you know, now you've got this tension where, on the one hand, people want to be unassuming and authentic, and that leads you to more and more casual clothing that's, you know, at least looks practical. But at the same time, people want to be expressive. And being stuck inside on Zoom has denied everyone the opportunity to just go out and kind of see and be seen, as we used to put it. So you've got the popularity of, you know, TV shows that have a like Bridgerton, and now everyone's talking about Regency fashions, or The Queen's Gambit or The Crown, and people are talking about you know, fashions in the 1950s and 1960s. And I think there are a lot of people who can't wait to try some of those out for themselves, or at least to try something that is flamboyant, you know, that says, here I am, now that we're finally out of quarantine.
That's so interesting. And you make a good point. Like, some of the most successful Netflix shows this year, like Bridgerton, Queen's Gambit, even Emily in Paris, they're very fashion-centered. They're all about apparel. And I wonder whether there is that kind of fantasy, this a sense of a lockdown country yearning for that kind of display.
I think there is. I even heard about a group of people who would dress up to take out the trash. You know, they were so, and it turned into like a cocktail party thing, you know, across the street with the trash can. So someone brought out a bottle of wine, and before you know it, there are these neighbors who come out with their trash cans and then, you know, it dressed up. And there's an Instagram page about it. So if people will do that, you know, I think we're ready to cut loose.
Richard Thompson Ford is the author of Dress Codes: How the Laws of Fashion Made History. He's a professor at Stanford Law School. And Henry Finder is the editorial director of The New Yorker and a guy who is never, please trust me on this, he is never going to wear sweatpants to the office.